A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one about puppetry education in the United States and the state of the art form right now. He is pointing to this surprising institutional depth, UConn's puppet arts program, the Ballard Institute, and wants us to trace the whole arc. Vaudeville, the WPA Federal Theater Puppet Units, the Henson Revolution, the 90s and 2000s art puppetry boom, and where things sit today with training, festivals, and that weird overlap with animatronics and AI-driven performance. Honestly, I didn't realize how much infrastructure there was until I started poking around.
Before we dive in, quick note, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro. Figured I'd mention that up front.
So where do we even start with this? I feel like most people think of puppetry as either Muppets or that creepy marionette their grandmother had. There's a whole institutional world behind it.
There really is, and the UConn program is the anchor of that world in the United States. Frank Ballard founded the Puppet Arts Program at the University of Connecticut in 1964, and this is still one of only a handful of degree-granting puppet programs in the country. It offers a BFA, an MA, and an MFA in Puppet Arts. Students train in everything from hand puppets to shadow puppets to marionettes to experimental object theater. The curriculum covers performance, design, construction, and history. It's not a club. It's a full conservatory-style program inside a public university.
You know something about this program, don't you?
I was around in those days. I grew up in Storrs, Connecticut, born and raised. Downtown Storrs wasn't much back then, mostly the old strip mall, the Price Chopper where my family did the weekly shop, and the campus. But the puppetry scene was already starting to hum. Frank Ballard was building something. I helped where I could.
What does helped where I could mean, exactly?
Moving boxes, mostly. Frank knew where to find me. I had a certain enthusiasm for the craft, and when you're a young donkey with time on your hands and an interest in the theatrical arts, people notice.
I'm going to let that sit there because I have no way to verify any of it. What I do know is that the Ballard Institute and Museum of Puppetry, which grew out of Frank Ballard's collection, now houses something like 2,500 puppets from around the world. It moved into a dedicated building in downtown Storrs in 2014, right in the Storrs Center development.
That's right. The collection is genuinely staggering. You've got Indonesian Wayang Kulit shadow puppets, Japanese Bunraku figures, Sicilian marionettes, and a huge archive of American puppetry from vaudeville through television. Frank Ballard started collecting in the 1960s, and the collection just grew and grew. After he retired in 1990, the Ballard Institute became a separate entity within the university. It's now both a museum and a research center, and it runs the National Puppetry Conference at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut.
The O'Neill Conference is a big deal, right? I've seen it described as the premier puppetry training event in the country.
It absolutely is. The O'Neill National Puppetry Conference was founded in 1990 with support from the Jim Henson Foundation, and it's been running every summer since. It brings in master puppeteers from around the world, people like Basil Twist, who's one of the most important figures in contemporary art puppetry, and Pam Arciero, who was a principal puppeteer on Sesame Street for decades. The conference is intensive, it's cross-disciplinary, and it's where a lot of working puppeteers go to push their craft beyond commercial work.
Let's back up. Daniel asked about the ARC, vaudeville, WPA, Henson, the art boom. What's the prehistory here? Because puppetry didn't start with Frank Ballard.
No, puppetry in the United States has roots going back to the 19th century, but the real institutional moment comes in the 1930s with the Federal Theater Project. This was part of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, and it included a dedicated puppetry unit. They staged productions across the country, often with political and social themes. The FTP. Puppet theaters did adaptations of Faust, they did anti-fascist satire, they did children's shows. It was the first time the federal government had ever funded puppetry as a serious art form.
This was all killed by Congress in 1939, right? The Federal Theater Project got defunded over accusations of communist sympathies.
The House Un-American Activities Committee went after the FTP hard, and the whole thing was shut down. But the puppeteers scattered into commercial theater, television, and education. A lot of them ended up influencing the next generation. Bill Baird is a key figure here. He started in vaudeville, worked in the Federal Theater Project, and then became one of the most famous puppeteers in America. He did the marionette sequence in The Sound of Music. He performed at the 1939 and 1940 World's Fairs. His work was seen by millions.
Baird's stuff was sophisticated. I've seen footage of his marionettes. The engineering alone is astonishing. He was doing things with string control that most people wouldn't attempt today.
Baird believed puppetry was a high art form, not just children's entertainment. He wrote a book called The Art of the Puppet in 1965 that's still referenced, and he directly influenced Jim Henson. Henson saw Baird's work as a teenager and has said it opened his eyes to what puppetry could be.
Which brings us to the Henson Revolution.
It really was a revolution. Jim Henson didn't just create beloved characters, he fundamentally changed the technology and the grammar of puppetry on screen. The Muppets used a technique Henson called soft puppetry, flexible foam and fabric construction that allowed for much more expressive movement than traditional hard puppets. But the bigger innovation was how Henson used the camera. He performed for the monitor, not the stage. He understood that puppetry on television needed tight framing, precise eye lines, and the illusion that the puppet was looking directly at the viewer. He basically invented the grammar of television puppetry.
He pushed into film. The Dark Crystal in 1982, Labyrinth in 1986. Those were massively ambitious projects that used animatronics alongside traditional puppetry. The Dark Crystal had no human actors at all. It was all puppets and animatronic creatures.
The Dark Crystal used something like 50 main puppet characters and hundreds of background figures. Jim Henson's Creature Shop developed entirely new techniques for cable-controlled facial expressions. The Skeksis puppets could blink, snarl, move their eyes independently. This was wildly advanced for its time, and that's where the overlap with animatronics really starts. Henson's Creature Shop continued after his death in 1990 and went on to do work for films like Babe and Where the Wild Things Are. The line between puppetry and animatronics has been blurry for decades.
Then the Henson Foundation became a major funder of puppet theater. They've given millions in grants to artists and institutions. The O'Neill Conference exists partly because of Henson Foundation support.
The Jim Henson Foundation was founded in 1982, and by the 2000s it was awarding something like $200,000 a year in grants to puppet artists. Cheryl Henson, Jim's daughter, has been deeply involved. The foundation has been one of the biggest single forces keeping American puppetry alive as an art form.
You've got the institutional backbone. UConn, the Ballard Institute, the O'Neill Conference, the Henson Foundation. What about the art puppetry boom of the 90s and 2000s? Daniel mentioned Bread and Puppet, Red Moon, Julie Taymor's Lion King.
Bread and Puppet Theater is one of the oldest and most politically radical puppet companies in the country. Peter Schumann founded it in New York in 1963, and it later moved to a farm in Glover, Vermont. Schumann's work is deliberately rough. Giant papier-mâché puppets, often 10 or 15 feet tall, used in street protests and pageants. The company is explicitly anti-war, anti-capitalist, and they've been a fixture of political demonstrations for decades. Their Domestic Resurrection Circus was a huge annual event in Vermont for many years.
Schumann's aesthetic is the polar opposite of Henson's polish, but it's incredibly influential. You see traces of Bread and Puppet in everything from climate protests to the giant puppet spectacles at the Olympics.
That brings us to Julie Taymor. She studied mime in Paris, studied Bunraku in Japan, worked with Bread and Puppet for a year, and then went on to design and direct The Lion King on Broadway in 1997. That show was a watershed moment for puppetry in mainstream theater. Taymor didn't hide the puppeteers. They were visible on stage, wearing neutral costumes, and the audience could see exactly how the puppets worked. The gazelle puppets were worn on the performers' heads and arms. The giraffes were actors on stilts. The elephant was a giant four-person contraption. It was puppetry as a visible, celebrated craft, not a hidden trick.
The Lion King has grossed something like $9 billion globally at this point. It's the highest-grossing Broadway show of all time. That's puppetry, front and center, in the most commercially successful theatrical production in history.
Taymor's work opened doors for a whole generation of puppet artists. Basil Twist is another key figure. He's a third-generation puppeteer who studied at the École Supérieure Nationale des Arts de la Marionnette in France, then came back to the U.S. and created Symphonie Fantastique in 1998. It was an abstract underwater puppet show set to Berlioz's symphony, performed in a 500-gallon tank of water with fabric, feathers, and dye. No dialogue, no characters in the traditional sense, just pure visual theater. It ran off Broadway for over a year, won an Obie Award, and toured internationally. That show, more than anything else, announced that puppetry for adults had arrived as a serious art form.
Red Moon Theater in Chicago was doing big spectacle stuff around the same time. They did massive outdoor pageants with giant puppets, mechanical contraptions, and community participation. They folded in 2015 after about 25 years, but their influence on the festival puppetry scene is real.
Red Moon's model, big community-driven spectacle with puppets, has been picked up by companies all over the country. You see it at the National Puppetry Festival, which is run by Puppeteers of America and happens every 2 years. You see it at regional festivals like the Chicago International Puppet Theater Festival, which has become one of the biggest in the world. The festival circuit is actually one of the main ways puppet artists make a living now. Touring puppet shows for adult audiences play at theaters, universities, and fringe festivals.
Is the form healthy? Daniel's question, is it thriving or hanging on?
I'd say it's healthy but precarious in some specific ways. On the thriving side, you've got more puppet theater for adults than at any point in American history. Companies like Manual Cinema in Chicago are doing sophisticated multimedia shadow puppet shows that play at major venues like the Kennedy Center. Phantom Limb Company does large-scale visual theater with puppets and has toured internationally. The Tank in New York runs a dedicated puppet series. The Form has critical respect and a growing audience.
The training pipeline?
That's where things get more complicated. UConn's program is still the flagship, but it's relatively small, typically around 20 to 30 students across all 3 degree levels at any given time. There's also a puppet arts concentration at West Virginia University, and the University of Texas at Austin has offered courses. But total enrollment in degree-granting puppet programs in the U.S. is probably under 100 students. Most working puppeteers learn through workshops, apprenticeships, the O'Neill Conference, or by just doing it.
The pedagogy is still very much an apprenticeship model, even with the university programs.
That's not necessarily a weakness. Puppetry is an inherently hands-on craft. You can't learn it from a textbook. The question is whether there are enough paid opportunities to sustain a professional class of puppeteers. The commercial side is concentrated in a few places. Sesame Workshop, The Muppets, Disney's Puppet Division, a handful of creature shops doing film and TV work. Outside of that, most puppet artists are piecing together grants, teaching gigs, festival bookings, and the occasional commercial job.
What about the animatronics and AI angle Daniel mentioned? That seems like it could either be a threat or an expansion of the form.
I think it's mostly an expansion, but it raises interesting questions. Animatronics have been part of puppetry since at least the 1980s. Henson's Creature Shop pioneered a lot of that. What's new is the integration of AI-driven performance. There are puppet systems now where the puppet's facial expressions are driven by machine learning models that respond to the puppeteer's voice or gestures in real time. The puppeteer is still performing, but the AI is handling micro-movements that would be impossible to control manually.
It's like an exoskeleton for expression.
Disney Imagineering has been doing a lot in this space. Their audio animatronics figures have gotten incredibly sophisticated. The Navi Shaman figure in the Pandora ride at Disney World has fluid, naturalistic movements that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. And there are research projects at places like MII. Tease Media Lab exploring what they call expressive robotics, which is basically puppetry with AI co-pilots.
Does that change what it means to be a puppeteer? If the machine is handling the fine motor control, what's the human doing?
The human is still making the artistic decisions, the timing, the emotional arc, the interaction with the audience. But I think it does shift the skill set. A puppeteer working with AI-driven systems needs to understand the technology at a deeper level. It's not just manipulating a puppet anymore, it's choreographing a hybrid performance system. And that's where I think the university programs have an opportunity. If UConn or another program started integrating AI and robotics into the puppet curriculum, they'd be training a new kind of artist.
I wonder if that's already happening informally. The O'Neill Conference has always attracted people from outside traditional puppetry. Animators, robotics people, installation artists. The cross-pollination is probably already there.
It definitely is. And the museum world has been a surprising driver of this. The Ballard Institute's exhibitions aren't just historical. They've commissioned new work that blends puppetry with digital media. The Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, which houses the largest collection of Henson artifacts in the world, has done exhibitions on puppetry in film and television that incorporate interactive digital elements. Museums have become patrons of experimental puppet work in a way that traditional theater funding hasn't always supported.
Let's talk about the adult puppetry renaissance more directly, because I think that's the biggest story of the last 20 years. When I was growing up, puppetry was basically Sesame Street and Punch and Judy. Now there's serious puppet theater playing at major venues.
There's been a real shift in audience perception. Part of it is generational. People who grew up with the Muppets and Labyrinth and the Dark Crystal are now adults with disposable income, and they're open to puppetry as an adult art form. Part of it is the festival circuit I mentioned. Part of it is that a few high-profile shows broke through. Avenue Q in 2003 was a big moment, a puppet musical for adults that won the Tony for Best Musical and ran on Broadway for 6 years. It was raunchy, it was funny, and it used the contrast between cute puppets and adult content to great effect.
Hand to God in 2015. Another puppet show on Broadway, this one about a possessed hand puppet, nominated for 5 Tonys, 1-2. The puppet was a character in its own right, and the show was unsettling.
Robert Askins, who wrote Hand to God, has said he was directly influenced by Bread and Puppet and by the idea that puppets can access something primal. A puppet on stage can say and do things that a human actor can't. There's a kind of permission that the form grants. Audiences accept violence, transgression, and surrealism from puppets that they'd resist from human performers.
That's a really interesting point. The puppet is a kind of safe container for dangerous material.
And that's been true throughout puppetry history. The traditional Punch and Judy show, which dates back to the 1600s in England, is full of domestic violence, murder, and gallows humor. Punch beats his wife, beats the baby, beats the policeman, and eventually beats the devil. It's been performed for children for centuries, but the content is dark. The puppet form makes it permissible.
The adult puppetry renaissance is partly a return to something that was always there. We just went through a period, maybe the mid-20th century, where puppetry got pigeonholed as children's entertainment.
Television did that. When puppetry moved to television in the 1950s and 60s, the economics pushed it toward children's programming. That's where the advertising dollars were. Henson himself chafed against that. He wanted to do more adult work, which is why he did things like the experimental short timepiece in 1965 and why The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth were aimed at older audiences. But the industry typecast puppetry, and it's taken decades to break out of that.
Is it fully broken out now, or is there still a ceiling?
I think there's still a ceiling in commercial theater. The Lion King is the exception, not the rule. Most puppet shows for adults play in 100-seat black boxes, not 1,000-seat Broadway houses. The economics are tough. A puppet show with a cast of 4 or 5 performers and elaborate puppets is expensive to mount and hard to tour. You're competing with solo shows and small-cast plays that can travel with a suitcase. So the form is artistically healthy but economically constrained.
What about international comparisons? Daniel mentioned that the U.S. has one of the only university puppet programs in the country. How does American puppetry education compare to other countries?
France has a much more robust institutional infrastructure. The École Nationale Supérieure des Arts et de la Marionnette in Charleville-Mézières is a full national conservatory that's been operating since 1987. It offers a 3-year degree program and is state-funded. Germany has puppetry programs at the Ernst Busch Academy of Dramatic Arts in Berlin and at the University of Music and Performing Arts in Stuttgart. The Czech Republic has a puppetry tradition going back centuries and university-level training. Compared to those, the U.S. is under-institutionalized.
The U.S. has the O'Neill Conference, which is arguably the most important puppetry training event in the English-speaking world. And the Henson Foundation's grant-making has no real equivalent in Europe. So it's a different model. Less state-supported, more foundation and festival-driven.
That's fair. And the U.S. has an advantage in commercial puppetry. The Muppets, Sesame Street, and the Disney Creature Shops are global brands. If you want to work in puppetry for film and television, the U.S. is still the place to be. The pipeline from UConn and the O'Neill Conference into those commercial jobs is real, even if it's narrow.
One thing I want to circle back to is the WPA puppet units. That was a moment when the federal government treated puppetry as public art worth funding. Has anything like that happened since?
Not at that scale. The National Endowment for the Arts has given grants to puppet artists and companies over the years, but it's piecemeal. There's no dedicated puppetry program at the NEA. The Henson Foundation and a few other private funders have filled the gap, but it's not the same as a federal commitment. The WPA puppet units employed hundreds of artists during the Depression and produced thousands of performances. That level of public investment hasn't been replicated.
Do you think it should be?
I think there's a case for it. Puppetry is a uniquely accessible art form. It can be performed outdoors, in public spaces, for audiences that might never set foot in a theater. It crosses language barriers. It's inherently collaborative and community-oriented. If you wanted to invest in making the arts more democratic, puppetry would be a smart place to put money.
That's a political argument, and I'm not sure I want to go down that road. But I take the point that puppetry has a public dimension that a lot of other art forms lack.
It really does, and that's part of what makes the current moment interesting. You've got puppet artists doing work in prisons, in refugee camps, in public parks. You've got the bread and puppet model of political street theater still going strong. You've got puppet slams, short-form puppet cabarets for adults, happening in cities all over the country. The form is finding its audience in a lot of different ways.
What's a puppet slam? I've heard the term, but never been to one.
It's basically an open mic night for puppeteers. Short pieces, usually 5 to 10 minutes, performed for an adult audience, often in a bar or small theater. They started in New York in the late 90s and have spread everywhere. The National Puppet Slam Network lists events in something like 30 cities. It's a grassroots, low-stakes way for puppeteers to try out new material and for audiences to discover the form.
That's another entry point into the training pipeline. You can show up at a puppet slam with a sock and an idea and see if it works.
And a lot of working puppeteers got their start that way. It's not a replacement for formal training, but it's a crucial part of the ecosystem. Puppetry is one of those forms where the barrier to entry is very low. You can make a puppet out of anything, but the barrier to mastery is extremely high. The puppet slam scene lets people start low and build.
I want to ask about one more thing before we wrap the core discussion. Daniel mentioned the overlap with animatronics and AI-driven performance. We talked about that mostly in terms of technique. But what about the philosophical question? At what point does a puppet become a robot? And does that matter?
That's a live debate in the puppetry world. Some purists argue that a puppet requires a live human performer in direct, real-time control. If the movement is pre-programmed or algorithmically generated, it's not puppetry, it's animation or robotics. Others argue that puppetry has always been about giving the illusion of life to an inanimate object, and the mechanism doesn't matter. Frank Ballard, for what it's worth, was in the latter camp. He defined puppetry broadly as the animation of inanimate objects in a theatrical context. Under that definition, an AI-driven robot performing on stage is puppetry.
I'm with Ballard on that one. The mechanism is secondary to the intent and the effect. If it's on stage and it's creating the illusion of life, it's puppetry.
And I think the boundaries are going to keep blurring. There are artists now working with what they call digital puppetry, performing CGI characters in real time using motion capture and facial tracking. That's how a lot of the characters in modern animated films are performed. The actor is puppeteering a digital object. Is that puppetry? I'd say yes.
The form isn't just surviving. It's expanding into new technologies and new audiences. The institutional infrastructure is small but real. The festival circuit is growing. The critical respect is there. The economics are tough, but when have they not been for artists?
That's a fair summary. I'd add one concern, which is the aging of the field. A lot of the master puppeteers, the people who trained under Ballard or worked with Henson, are in their 60s and 70s. The question is whether enough young artists are coming up behind them. The university programs are small and the apprenticeship pathways are informal. I'm not panicking about it, but it's something to watch.
No, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the late 1600s, shipwrights in the Namib Desert, specifically around the Skeleton Coast, where Portuguese and Dutch vessels frequently wrecked, developed a specialized adze for salvaging iron fittings from ship hulls. The adze head was forged with a curved beak that measured exactly one cape foot, which was roughly 12.4 modern inches, standardized to the Rhineland foot used by Dutch East India Company shipwrights. A single cape foot adze could strip the iron strapping from a wrecked fluet in under 3 days.
I don't know what to do with the phrase cape foot adze. The open question for me is whether puppetry's institutional infrastructure can scale to match the growing audience interest. The demand seems to be there. The supply of trained artists is the bottleneck. And that's probably where we should leave it, watching to see if the university programs grow, if new ones emerge, if the festival circuit keeps expanding. The form is healthy, but it's at an inflection point.
Thanks as always to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the prompt. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.